Hi, I'm Nyla Boodoo, host of Axios Today. It's a daily podcast that gives you the latest scoops and analysis to power your day. But we don't just run through the headlines. We provide the important stories you won't get anywhere else. Everything from politics to space to race and justice. So grab a cup of coffee or a cup of tea for me and join me for 10 minutes every morning to get up to speed for the day ahead. You can listen to Axios Today on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. Meet Wise, one account for over 50 currencies, because today your life is bigger than one currency. Whether you're sending pesos to your parents, receiving dollars from a friend, or spending in euros, you can do it all in one account. With Wise, you can manage your money across borders cheaper, faster, and easier. Join 13 million people and businesses who are already saving, and try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
In Sri Lanka, very long lines for gas. To fill up the tank, that line will last days.
I want to be positive. Somehow I will get it today. That's it, because I don't think I can take another day off and I have two kids at home.
Also today, the Pope delivers a long-awaited apology to Indigenous leaders in Canada for the role the church played in the abuse and deaths of schoolchildren. Many believe saying, "I'm sorry," just isn't good enough.
A lot of people are also really wanting to better understand an action plan by the Catholic Church.
I'm Marco Werman, and we remember British chef Diana Kennedy, who shared her passion for Mexican cuisine with the wider world.
I really think the entire country of Mexico will forever be indebted to her efforts.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being here this Monday. We start today with a long-awaited apology from the Pope to the Indigenous people of Canada. Pope Francis is in Canada this week, visiting the sites of former residential schools, places where the Canadian government sent Indigenous children in the name of education, but in reality it was an attempt to erase their culture. On top of that, children in these schools often faced abuse. Thousands also died from that abuse or sheer neglect. The Catholic Church played a role running some of the schools. Today, Pope Francis apologized. The Pope said, "I would like to tell you from the bottom of my heart that I am very sorry." We reached out to Crystal Fraser this morning before Francis spoke. She's an assistant professor of Native Studies, History, Classics, and Religion at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. I asked her about the significance of the Pope's visit.
This is a very significant time in Canada for survivors of Indian residential schools, and Indigenous survivors and leaders have been calling for this apology actually for decades. The reason why this is happening right now is because of the international headlines last year around unmarked graves, around these conversations now being understood in the context of genocide. And it is widely thought that this visit and this apology will advance the healing in this country. It will help facilitate reconciliation. But I think really a lot of people are really wanting to better understand an action plan by the Catholic Church, that a simple apology is not good enough, that we need to know how things are going to change.
We've learned over time about the grim results of the residential schools. I mean, your own family faces, and we'll discuss that in a moment, but what were these places like? What was their goal?
The system was vast. It operated for over a century, from coast to coast to coast, really. Over 150,000 Indigenous children were institutionalized there. And it was really a program to remove children from their families. Indigenous families were seen as uncivilized and backwards and savage and really a barrier to civilization. And so full stop, this was removal from land and family and language and culture. and immersion into, you know, a Euro-Canadian education, which included Christianity, the speaking of French or English. But these schools also couldn't operate without the labor of these children. And so they were often drudges. They were often treated very violently. The rates of abuse and sexual assault were very high at these institutions. And now the rates of death were also sometimes as high as 50%.
That's extraordinary. So let me come back to some of the reaction you were talking about, that not everybody is satisfied with what's going on. What sorts of actions are people hoping for beyond an apology from the Pope?
First and foremost, the Catholic Church continues to owe survivors about $30 million in compensation that has not been paid. And when you put that in the bigger context of this papal visit, the papal visit is costing taxpayers about $35 million. The Canadian government has put that forward for this visit. Additionally, there are very strong calls for the papal bull, the Doctrine of Discovery. There are calls for that to be repealed. And then additionally, you know, the Catholic Church continues to profit from their land holdings in Canada. Our lands that are currently owned by the Catholic Church, are they willing to return those to their rightful owners, to Indigenous nations? And then additionally, there is this ongoing question, you know, about access to records and to archives and the vast collection of cultural artifacts that continue to be housed in Rome that were really acquired through mysterious circumstances or through a gifting process that cannot be traced.
Crystal, members of your own family went to residential schools. What was the story of these places that you learned growing up?
One of the last ones that closed in Canada was in Inuvik in Grolier Hall. I lived right across the street from it. But growing up, these kinds of stories were just not talked about. It was so painful. And it actually wasn't until I went to university in the mid-2000s that I learned about residential schools.
I'm wondering, when was the last time you drove by that school that you used to see across from your house as a kid? And what did you feel once you know that story?
I did not have a great understanding of what that place was. I knew that, you know, not good things happened there. You know, my parents always warned me never go there. I knew that some of the children that were my friends and that I hung out with, that is where they lived, that they were away from home, that they didn't have parents.
Crystal Fraser is an assistant professor of Native Studies, History, Classics, and Religion at the University of Alberta. She joined us from Edmonton. Thank you very much, Crystal.
Yeah.
The military junta in Myanmar announced today that it has executed four pro-democracy activists, the first executions in Myanmar in more than three decades. It's seen as the latest attempt to instill fear in the resistance movement there. Matthew Pennington is following all of this. He's a senior managing editor at Radio Free Asia and joins us from Washington. Matt, what do we know about the four people who were hanged by the junta in Myanmar?
Well, two of the four are very prominent pro-democracy figures in Myanmar. The other two we don't really know much about. So the ones we know about are Ko Jimmy. He was renowned as a student activist during a democracy uprising back in 1988, which was a sort of seminal event in Myanmar's history. And since then, you know, when Myanmar had a democratic opening about 10 years ago, he became increasingly prominent, and he was seen as a sort of figure of reconciliation. The other prominent person who was executed is someone called Pyozer Tor, and he had actually become famous as a hip-hop star, and he was elected to parliament in 2012, and he was a close associate of Myanmar's famous civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi.
What was the government's, the military junta's justifications for the executions? Why did they say these activists deserved death?
Well, in the cases of Ko Jimmy and Pyozer Tor, they were accused of ties with a shadow government, the National Unity Government, which was sort of set up by lawmakers in the former parliament that were ousted in the coup, and also ties with civilian militia There are said to have ordered attacks on police and junta targets. We don't really know anything about the substance of any of these allegations because all of the trials were in military courts, which are secret. So we just don't have any readout on the substance of those trials and if there's any substance to the allegations.
What's been international response to the news of these executions?
Well, so far, there's just been condemnation. The White House has condemned it. UN Human Rights Chief called it a cruel and regressive step. We're still waiting to hear from governments in the region, in Southeast Asia, which I think this puts them in a bit of a diplomatic bind because I think there's going to be pressure from the West for a greater condemnation of the junta's actions.
Do you expect the junta to dig in its feet at this point?
Well, it seems that's the calculation they are making. There are some people who speculate that this may be a reflection of the junta's reverses on the battlefield. It's facing strong armed resistance across the country from these civilian militias that have built up and also from ethnic armed groups. And we know that they've sustained considerable casualties.
Myanmar, of course, is a notoriously hard place to get information out of. Western journalists generally can't enter the country. All this has kind of gotten especially true since the junta staged its coup last year. How are you able to know all these details?
There are still people who are able to post videos and photos on social media, despite the restrictions that the junta has imposed on the internet. Some media organizations, including our own, have sources inside the country who send information to us. I mean, one example is that there haven't been any protests yet against these executions, but we learned that today on Monday, someone unfurled a banner from a bridge in Yangon that read, "Get ready to pay the blood debt," which sounded like a call to arms from activists who are in Myanmar's main city. And also, Radio Free Asia, we do reach out to the military when we can to get their view on events. And we called them today, but we got no response.
Matt, is the government in Myanmar prosecuting any others with the death penalty? I mean, you said there are some 100 people on death row in Myanmar. Do you expect to see more executions?
Well, it seems like that might be likely. It would certainly be a sort of tactic and strategy of instilling fear. But whether that would work or not is really up for debate because I think people are going through such an intense conflict. There are airstrikes happening in conflict zones. There are many thousands of villages being displaced. Mm. It's sort of reaching a point where people have nothing to lose.
Matthew Pennington, Senior Managing Editor at Radio Free Asia. He joined us from Washington to talk about this news from Myanmar of 4 executions of activists. Matt, thanks for taking the time.
You're welcome. Thanks.
The cooking world lost a legend over the weekend. Chef Diana Kennedy was a British journalist and author who spent decades studying, cooking, and writing about traditional Mexican cuisine. She died yesterday at her home in the Mexican state of Michoacán.
I really think the entire country and people of Mexico will forever be indebted to her efforts.
Patty Hinich is from Mexico City, well known as a chef, author, and host of Patty's Mexican Table. She first met Diana Kennedy while working on another cooking show about 25 years ago. Hinich says Kennedy had the whole production crew over for breakfast.
And she welcomed us with a Mexican torta. She had her homemade refried beans, homemade pickled jalapenos, and homemade guacamole. And it was probably the best torta I've ever eaten.
Hinich was impressed with the food and Kennedy's love for Mexico.
I was in awe. You know, her enthusiasm, her love for the country, her thorough and really rigorous research.
All that knowledge was a result of years of traveling throughout Mexico.
Muchas personas pensaban que ponía la pepita pelada en sus moles. Pero aquí no.
You can watch Kennedy on YouTube. She is totally focused on picking up traditional techniques from home cooks and talking to people at local markets about their region's ingredients.
Y este chile, ¿cómo se llama aquí?
Chile de uña de pico.
Uña de pico. Es el árbol, chile de árbol.
Diana Kennedy's work earned her high acclaim. She published 9 cookbooks, won 4 James Beard Awards, and received an Order of the Aztec Eagle from the Mexican government, the highest decoration awarded to foreigners for cultivating the cuisine and tourism of Mexico. Over the years, a few critics have questioned the ethics of a white British woman becoming one of the major faces of Mexican cuisine. Patty Heenich has heard those comments and does not think they're fair.
She had the utmost respect to anything Mexican, and she credited all of the people that worked with her and that were the sources of her recipes and her food. I don't know any Mexican chef that doesn't admire her work.
That is understandable. After all, Chef Diana Kennedy leaves behind a legacy of celebrating and sharing with the world Mexican cuisine. She was 99. You are with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. Over just this past weekend, more than 1,000 migrants were rescued in the Mediterranean. At least 5 died. The sea crossing from North Africa and the Middle East to Southern Europe is one of the most dangerous migration routes in the world. Still, this year, there's been a huge uptick in the number of people attempting to do it. This weekend, a ship run by the German humanitarian group Sea-Watch rescued people from overcrowded rubber boats. Some had to be pulled from the water. Alan Ruiz Terol has our story.
A video provided by Sea-Watch shows 100 people packed in a boat adrift in the Mediterranean Sea. They wave and cry for help, but the rescue crew approaching the scene on boat urge them to stop moving and stay calm. A shipwreck now could have fatal consequences, so they must act quickly. The crew hurries to distribute life vests and instruct them how to put them on. Only then do they start evacuating people, carrying them on a Zodiac-style boat to a larger rescue ship.
You see it?
Over the weekend, the crew on board of the Sea-Watch 3 repeated this operation not one or two, but 5 times. In all, 444 people were rescued. Mattia Vaya, a spokesperson for the organization, explains that some castaways were in such poor condition that had to be evacuated by the Italian Coast Guard.
One was a heavily pregnant woman, and one was a very small child that had experienced fuel burn, so they were evacuated with their family members.
With the remaining people on board, the ship headed to Sicily, where Italian authorities should offer them a safe harbor, at least in theory. But the NGO is hardly optimistic.
We're continuing to pressure them and basically tell them that they need to disembark them as soon as possible. But given our experiences and also the experiences of other search and rescue NGOs, this is going to take probably a couple of days still.
Sea-Watch officials fear that staying several days stranded could have dire consequences for those on board. Not only physically, but also mentally.
They have been through torture, they have been through abuse, they have been through exploitation. They've been sitting on boats for some of them for days in the central Mediterranean Sea without sufficient food, water, or any other forms of supplies.
For years, sea rescue groups have faced a tough time disembarking migrants in Italy and other European countries. On Sunday, the far-right politician Matteo Salvini tweeted that, quote, "more deaths, more landings, more money for traffickers." He then called on people to change the situation and vote for him to be Italy's next prime minister. Migration is said to be a key issue in the upcoming election and one of the main rallying points of some parties. Luigi Achilli is a senior researcher at the Migration Policy Center of the European University Institute in Florence.
Both left-wing and right-wing political groups, they are all endorsing a tightening of border controls. I mean, there is not so much of a difference.
Here is Mattia Vaya again.
What we are witnessing is basically the very, very dangerous mixture of a high number of people fleeing and at the same time a refusal yet again by the European authorities to actually act on this rise of numbers. And this is something that needs to change in the future because this is something that will continue also throughout the next years.
For the world, I'm Alan Ruterol.
The Horn of Africa is experiencing its worst drought in 40 years. We reported on this when the signs were ominous a few months ago. Now nearly 250,000 people are facing starvation across Djibouti, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia, and parts of Kenya. Will Swanson is with the UN's Food and Agricultural Organization, the FAO, based in Nairobi. Let's focus, Will, on one of the hardest hit places, Somalia. Nearly half the people there don't have enough food and are facing food insecurity. I mean, half the population. How recently were you in Somalia? What are people dealing with there?
Yeah, look, I was just recently in the areas of Puntland in Somalia and also in the southern part of Somalia, in rural areas where the drought is really starting to hit hard. I mean, we've had 4 failed rainy seasons in Somalia now, and it's just wreaked havoc on rural communities. You know, the water's disappeared, the pastures dried up, the crops have failed. People are just really struggling with this emergency. It's a real tragedy.
You took one video that I saw, and in it, dozens of people are walking by the camera. It's really nothing short of an exodus. People mostly on foot, a few donkeys. I mean, you point out, as you just said, this is a farming community, but they walked nearly 90 miles to get help. What is their story?
Yeah, that's correct. We met this particular community at an IDP camp in a town on the border with Ethiopia.
Internally displaced people camp.
Yeah, and this community, they'd been on the road for 10 days. One of the ladies told me that they had lost 2 children to illness along the way. Another woman was giving her child dirty water mixed with bark for some form of sustenance. You know, they just really came with what they had on their backs and a few donkeys to transport the children. This happens every day all over southern Somalia.
To what extent is drought driving the current food shortage?
Well, I mean, Somalia, in terms of the food producing regions, has been seeing continual decrease in rainfall. They have 2 main rainy seasons per year, and since late 2020, they've just been failing. And this has really affected local food production. And Somalia only actually produces a small amount of its own food. So when productivity goes down in terms of livestock, agriculture, it affects people very viscerally in the rural areas.
Well, as you point out, I mean, droughts are not a new thing in the Horn of Africa, but has climate change made matters worse?
What we're seeing in Somalia is definitely an increase in erratic weather and the effects of climate change. Over the last 10 years, the number of droughts has increased in frequency, as well as floods. When there's no drought, it's often flooding. And of course, in the last 2 years, there's also been a locust infestation that came up around 2020 that also decimated crops.
So aside from these quote-unquote natural causes, the war in Ukraine, we know, has driven up food prices globally. Is that impacting the situation as well?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's definitely playing a role here, as it has globally. But in the last 2 years, global food prices have reached record highs anyway. You know, cost of inputs, fuel, fertilizer, COVID-19, all these things have affected, you know, global food prices. And Somalia imports something up to like 78% of the food requirements it needs. So for communities who are losing out on their income because of the drought are also facing increasing food prices because of these global factors, and they're just being squeezed in the middle.
Are there fundamental fixes that need to be undertaken that are not?
There are small things that can be done in terms of just helping communities to manage their resources better, providing drought-resistant seeds and better farming practices to cope with these erratic rainfall, but also just helping with things like governance in Somalia and also just helping to improve food systems and getting products to market, helping producers produce more food, manage what resources they have.
So right now, what is your organization, the FAO, doing to alleviate the hunger just in the short term?
We're providing cash transfers to vulnerable families, also helping with seeds and tools, implements that help them get back to work sooner when the rains do come.
Will Swanson with the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization. He's based in Nairobi. Thanks so much. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Marco.
We'll be right back with more in the next half hour. You're listening to The World. They arrived illegally in the U.S. as children, then their parents' work visas expired. Now the kids are 21 and trying to get their own green cards. Red tape means a very long wait for 2 sisters in that situation.
80-plus years, with the threat of deportation to India hanging over their heads.
Their fight on behalf of 200,000 others like them still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, you're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The World Health Organization declared monkeypox a global health emergency over the weekend. Monkeypox is an infectious disease and in recent months has spread rapidly across several countries in Africa and Europe. The U.S. has also seen cases dramatically rise in recent weeks. There is some good news. A vaccine exists. It's just not yet widely available for everybody in all parts of the world. With us to explain what's going on is Dr. Ali Mokhtad. He's a professor of global health at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. So a vaccine is good news, but let's start with the basics, doctor. What are the symptoms of monkeypox?
So the symptoms are fever, headache, muscle ache, and backache, followed by a rash. And you will see blisters that are appearing usually all over the body, on hands, feet, chest, and genitals.
And is monkeypox ever fatal?
It has a low mortality rate. So in certain parts in Africa, the mortality could go up to 10%. Fortunately for us in the United States, it's very low mortality.
And how is monkeypox spread, primarily among whom? Any particular demographics?
In countries where it comes from in Africa, it spreads across all the population. Right now, what we are seeing in the West, it's mainly spreading among men who have sex with men.
I'd like to get your reaction to the WHO's decision to call the spread of monkeypox a global health emergency. Do you think this was the right decision?
Yes, it's a right decision in my opinion. And the reason for that decision, because it's now started to spread to the general community. So if you look at HIV/AIDS, for example, it started in a gay community in San Francisco, and now everybody could be infected by HIV and could get AIDS. And we're seeing the same patterns here, although it started among men having sex with men, gay men, but it's now spreading to the general community. In the United States, if you remember, we had two cases among children.
With the WHO declaring monkeypox a global health emergency, though, what does that actually do? Does it suggest the WHO is trying to get ahead of the disease?
Yes, it's getting ahead of the disease, but the most important part, allows government to seek resources and borrow money if they need to in order to address the problem. It also empowers the surveillance system in countries so they can report the disease. And then it gives attention to the problem at the local level, where prevention is very important and early detection and doing contact tracing is very important.
Yeah, but will that happen? I mean, we're in the middle of a COVID pandemic. How ready is the WHO to fight several fires at once?
It's not the WHO, it's countries. You know, most medical systems, let's be honest, medical systems are exhausted. And we're having a hard time also right now tracking COVID-19. So yes, there is no good time for monkeypox, but this came on top of a pandemic. Yes, many countries, unfortunately, will struggle. And the WHO announcement will help people ask, government ask for resources.
So as I said, there is a vaccine for monkeypox, but it's not readily available in a number of countries. How's that going to be dealt with now that the WHO has issued this warning? Can production rapidly meet the growing demand?
You've heard in New York, for example, when the vaccine is available, there are lines and they run out of vaccines. So there is right now, with the declaration of WHO, there'll be an increase in production of the vaccine and prophylaxis as well. And yes, the vaccine is highly effective. The other thing to keep in mind that we have a vaccine specifically for monkeypox, but also the vaccine for smallpox is 85% effective. And countries that have that vaccine available in storage, we've had some here in the United States, could start administering that vaccine as well.
And what are the competing kind of medical demands with the COVID pandemic? I mean, supply chains are broken. Will that impact the reaction to monkeypox?
Of course, supply chain are, you know, we're not able to provide the COVID vaccine for every country out there. There are resources that are lagging in many countries. Even if they have the vaccine, they don't have all the equipment to deliver a vaccine for COVID-19. Of course, we want to make sure that this will not become a pandemic, although the chances of it becoming a pandemic is much lower than COVID-19. But still, you want to provide the vaccine and make sure the informations are out there to prevent the spread of this virus.
That's good news to hear you're encouraged, but how concerned are you that monkeypox cases will continue to increase? And do you think that increase is going to be rapid?
Yes, unfortunately, they will increase, especially in many places right now, like the United States, because we had a delayed reaction to the introduction of monkeypox in our community, partly again, because physicians did not expect to see monkeypox in many countries. And now that everybody is alerted, so I'm more optimistic that we will be able to control it.
Right now, though, what can people do to protect themselves? People anywhere, what do you advise?
The usual precautions, wear a mask if you are around somebody who is at high risk or infected, of course. Wash your hands and keep a distance. And the same apply here. And then we need to make sure that the government is able and countries are able to detect a case as soon as possible, trace the contact, and make sure we don't allow this virus to spread through preventive measures, masks, washing hands, gloves, etc.
Dr. Ali Mokhtad is a professor of global health at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. Thank you very much indeed. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
1 month ago today, the government in Sri Lanka said the country was nearly out of gasoline. Government employees were mostly told to stay home. Classrooms were shuttered. The country's farmers and fishermen have also been feeling the pain. They don't have enough fuel to power their tractors and boats. Then last week, gas stations across Sri Lanka received their first new shipments of fuel. Great news for the few lucky buyers who can get their hands on some. The World's Carolyn Beeler saw this in person. She waited online at a gas station in Sri Lanka's capital, Colombo.
Kalum Jayantha is a hotel driver in Colombo, but he says for the past 2 months, his job has really been to wait in line. He's sitting in the car, pulled up right next to the gas pump. He tells me and my interpreter, Naresh Eliyatambi, that last night, after waiting in line all day, the gas ran out right as he was about to get some.
So when the fuel ran out, he was really upset. He thought to himself, what's this life that he's leading?
But he says if he doesn't have fuel, he can't work.
He says he has two children, and if he loses his job, he'd have to look at leaving the country.
In his chauffeur's uniform, Jayantha looks tired and says he's frustrated with the government here, who he blames for this crisis. Sri Lanka defaulted on its debt in May and ran out of dollars to buy imports like fuel and medicine. As we talk, Jayantha looks over my shoulder and breaks into a grin. A fuel truck is pulling up into the gas station.
Then everyone's suddenly looking happy here.
Everyone's smiling. People can start filling up soon, but supplies will be tightly rationed, and it's impossible to say just how many are still waiting. So walking away from the gas station through a crowd of men who've gathered to watch the fuel tanker unload its gas, I meet a man who has been waiting in line for diesel for 6 days. Nishantha Da Costa tells me he has to steel himself up emotionally to get fuel these days.
He says you need to not think about it much, not get upset about it. Psychologically, you know, people have hit rock bottom.
His office is nearby, so he goes in there once a day for a meal and to wash up, then returns to his car to sleep. He shows me how he reclines the passenger side seat and sleeps. How is it?
It's not comfortable. After a little while, he'd wake up, then he'd go back to sleep. So it's a very fitful sleep.
A whole subculture has popped up here around this national nightmare. People do Zoom meetings on their laptops in their cars. Your neighbor behind you in line will take your keys and move your car for you if the line inches forward while you're getting lunch. Smartphone apps tell you which gas stations are supposed to be supplied next. I decide to try to walk to the end of this line to see exactly how long it is.
So we walk past a big hotel, past the motorbikes lined up on the sidewalk, past a bike selling ice cream.
After about 20 minutes of walking, I meet one of the few women in line.
I'm Gayatri Sivayoganathan.
She's an optimist. Thinks her odds of getting gas today are pretty good.
I want to be positive. Somehow I will get it today. That's it, because I don't think I can take another day off and I have two kids at home.
Her mom's watching them.
So you had to take the day off work. You had to get your mom to watch your kids just to maybe get gas.
Yeah, but I don't want to say maybe. I want to get it somehow.
She spent 16 years living in the north while Sri Lanka's civil war was raging. She says this reminds her of that time.
We used to stay in the queue. So same, we are again waiting in the queue to get the essentials.
But there's no war.
No war, yeah. But this is the war. War is like fighting for the basics now.
At the very end of the line, a full mile away from the gas station, is Jacita Ganes Fernando. He's not sure if he's going to get any gas, but he's prepared to wait. There's no point in going home without petrol, he tells me, so he's brought a change of clothes. I felt bad for Fernando and Sivyogananden because neither of them got gas that day. The station ran out by the evening. On the streets here, there is some traffic once again, but nowhere near the gridlock you'd usually see. The current supply of gas is expected to last a few weeks at least and keep the cars and motorbikes on the streets here. But sustained relief from Sri Lanka's gas shortage isn't expected until the International Monetary Fund comes through with a bailout, and that could take months. Until then, lots of people in this country will continue to spend a lot of time waiting for gas. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler on the much less busy-than-usual streets of Colombo.
If you've been to Iceland or seen pictures of it, you know there's not a lot of tree cover. It's a pretty barren landscape. It was not always that way, though. About a quarter of Iceland used to be covered with trees. Then, around 1,200 years ago, the Vikings showed up and proceeded to cut them all down to make houses and create pastures. More than a millennia later, Icelanders are now trying to reforest. Adelstein Sigurd Gerson is deputy director of the Icelandic Forestry Association. Adelstein, what kind of trees used to grow in Iceland pre-Vikings?
Well, Iceland is an island in the middle of the ocean, so not many species made it here after the end of the Ice Age. The forests that used to be here 1,000 years ago were just composed of one species, basically, being downy birch. So these were birch forests.
So are you trying to reintroduce these birch or different ones?
Well, we're doing a bit of both. Of course, restoration of birch woodlands is an important target here for many people, and we're trying to do that. But we're also trying to grow more diverse species from other countries, meaning alien or exotic species that grow well in Iceland, actually grow much better than the native birch. And these often come from areas that are very climatically similar to Iceland, such as the coast of Alaska in the U.S.
So what are the primary motivations for this project of planting more trees in Iceland?
Well, the motivation has been long to create shelter and better living conditions for the population in many ways. I mean, that was the original idea behind trying to plant forest here. And that's still an important focus, as well as soil conservation, stopping erosion, which is our number one environmental problem today. But in the most recent decades, the climate issue has become, well, overshadowing almost everything else, so that we are very interested also in sequestering more carbon in natural forests for decreasing the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere.
So I'm curious, by the time the Vikings were done chopping down a lot of these trees, how many remained in Iceland?
I think the lowest point would have been maybe a century ago, when we had less than 1% of the country covered with some kind of forest or scrub woodland remnant. Now we have reached finally the goal where we can say that forests are increasing, not decreasing. We have about 2% forest cover, and 1.5% of that is native birch, and the rest is planted forests of various species, including birch. Our aim is actually to try to sequester as much as we can, and at the same time build a kind of foundation for the use of forests and forest recreation and other things that people in forested countries are more used to. Keep in mind that Iceland is, well, it's the least forested country in Europe, for one thing, but I think it's in seventh place with regard to poor forest cover in the world. We're right down there with Saudi Arabia and other desert countries that have little forest cover.
I mean, the Vikings aside, Iceland seems like a pretty tough environment for trees. How hard will it be to reforest Iceland?
Well, Iceland is cool, but it's not really cold, you see. We have cool summers. We had mild winters. We have a very oceanic climate, so we have long growing seasons, but the growing seasons are rather cool and rainy. We have ample rainfall in most areas. So from that point of view, trees will grow if they are adapted to our climate, and many of these are.
So is the goal now to reforest Iceland back to what it was pre-Vikings, where it was like a quarter of the country was covered with forests, or something less ambitious?
Less ambitious, let's say. We are aiming at a few more percentages, and If you ask me, of course, I would like to restore whatever was lost. But there are political aims, including matters like free-ranging sheep grazing that continues all throughout the country. Every time you want to plant a tree, you first have to erect a fence to keep your neighbor's sheep out. There are also issues involved with tourism and, well, people being used to having treeless environments. Some consider that treelessness as some kind of a naturalness that has to be preserved. So we, of course, have very little political clout over all these competing issues. But we would like to see a few more percentages, and even just 5% would be enough, for example, to make Iceland carbon neutral.
Yeah, I was wondering, is there political pressure to get to net zero in Iceland, and how much will reforesting actually help Iceland reach its goal?
Well, it is political pressure for the country to become carbon neutral. In fact, it's in our state law since 1 or 2 years ago that Iceland will become, not aiming to become, but will become carbon neutral by 2040. And afforestation is one of the tools in that toolkit. Other things being, for example, converting to electric EV vehicles instead of diesel or gasoline, changing the fishing fleet, which is a major emitter here. But then the issue remains that one of the largest single emitters in this country is actually land use and land. Every average square kilometer or square mile of land is probably emitting a lot more than it sequesters at present because of the poor vegetation and the soils that are slowly degrading.
So, Adelstein, how long are we talking about in terms of getting back any sizable forests in Iceland?
Well, it all depends on the motivation, you see. We could do this in a matter of a decade or two if we put very much effort into it. But at the current rate where we're maybe restoring or planting 1,500 to 2,000 hectares a year, this will take a very long time. That goal alone, 5%, will take probably the rest of the century.
Adelstein Sigurd Garrison is Deputy Director of the Icelandic Forestry Association, speaking with us about the effort to put back what the Vikings took away, trees. Thank you, Adelstein.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Turning 21 is a coming-of-age milestone, but for 200,000 young people in the U.S., it's an age that catapults them into legal limbo. We're talking here about people who came legally as children to the U.S. on their parents' work visa. Once they reach 21, they age out and become subject to deportation. Contrast that with the Dreamers who arrived along with their parents without documentation but are allowed to stay in the U.S. under the DACA program or the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. For the non-Dreamers we're talking about for this next story, those who could get deported, many of them are now online for their green cards. With current wait times, it could literally be decades before their cards arrive. Reporter Rachel Miro of KQED met two sisters working to change the rules.
Eti and Eva Sinha were 7 years old when they moved with their mom from New Delhi to San Francisco.
Yes. Yeah, we're twins.
1 minute apart, to be exact.
The Sinha sisters grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area.
We kind of had a pretty typical, like, American upbringing. We learned how to ride our bikes in Golongi Park. We loved eating all, like, the Asian food in San Francisco and Bay Area. Just children growing up in the Bay.
They joined their dad, who was getting a PhD in business. Now he runs his own Silicon Valley consulting firm, and mom is the director of admissions at a local university.
We never really felt out of place. We had a lot of other friends who were immigrants, either second and third generation immigrants, and I found quite a few friends who were immigrants themselves who came in elementary school along with their parents.
Unlike children who were brought to the U.S. illegally and qualified for protected DACA status, Eva and Eti were here legally on their dad's temporary visa. And like many of their schoolmates, their parents were in line for a green card for the right to live and work in the U.S. more or less indefinitely. Eva and Eti were dependents, riding on their family's application.
Most of my friends had gotten their green card by the time they were in high school.
That's what their parents expected would happen for them. But just after their family arrived in the U.S., A backlog started to develop because of a quota system set in place back in 1991. Every single country gets the same percentage of green cards given out in any one year. No more than 7% of the total in any given year goes to applicants from any one country, whether you're from Albania or Zimbabwe. But of course, there are way more people from India and China applying, especially so they can work in Silicon Valley. So starting in the early aughts, year after year, the line got longer and longer and longer.
Our parents applied in 2011 when we were in middle school.
It only dawned on the Sinha sisters in high school that their green cards might not arrive in time for college, that they might turn 21 while in college and suddenly switch from dependent to adult. Suddenly, they would become ineligible for everything from in-state tuition at a public school in California to all kinds of grants and loans. I couldn't help but ask the Sinha sisters if they blame their parents. Eva said no.
They've paid all their taxes, they're following all the rules. And, you know, once their turn in line comes up, they would get their green card. It's just there's a backlog.
And while their 21st birthdays were a reason to celebrate.
Happy birthday!
Happy birthday, Andy!
That day also marked a turning point. According to the federal government, they were now on their own, foreign nationals who needed to apply for temporary visas to stay in the U.S. legally. Some people suggested Eva and Eti apply as undocumented to take advantage of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals or DACA programs.
But no one wants to be undocumented. No one asked for that.
They didn't want to drop off the federal government's radar, to risk living the rest of their lives in the shadows, likely cut off from any pathway to citizenship. After they graduated, cum laude, one from UC San Diego, the other from UC Santa Barbara, Eti and Eva became experts on the visa system here in the U.S. Eti is on an F1 now, an academic visa.
I am a PhD student at Cornell University in New York, studying biomedical engineering.
Eva's employer sponsored her for an H1B, the most common in Silicon Valley.
I currently work as a financial analyst in San Francisco.
That H1B is temporary, of course.
6 years since I got it in 2020, so 2026.
Got that? She's only good to stay in the U.S. until 2026, unless her employer applies for a renewal or a green card, or she returns to her quote-unquote home country, a country she's visited but doesn't consider home.
Hopefully my employer will apply for a green card for me, but I don't know.
The current estimate is like 80 plus years.
Yeah, so yeah.
80 plus years. They laugh, but 80 plus years with the threat of deportation to India hanging over their heads.
We're American every way, but on paper.
It's so obvious to everyone, but for some reason, not the U.S. government.
After Eti graduates, she'll have to do the same thing as Eva, find an employer to sponsor her for an H-1B and then a green card. Essentially, they're both hopscotching from one temporary visa to another to stay in this country. There's a name for this dilemma, for what Eti and Eva have become, documented dreamers.
Today, I'm representing over 40,000 documented dreamers in the state of California.
At a recent committee hearing in Sacramento, Eva testified on behalf of a state bill that would have, if it had passed, made the cost of a college education in California a little bit more feasible for the documented dreamers coming after Eva and Eti.
At age 7, I immigrated with my family alongside my twin sister from India to San Francisco.
Their best hope now is a bill that was passed by the House of Representatives earlier this month.
There's a realistic chance, like, we could permanently end aging out by the end of the year.
That's 26-year-old Deep Patel, founder of the advocacy group Improve the Dream, which coined the term documented dreamers. The bill was included as an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act, the military spending bill that must be approved each year. The Senate will now vote on its own version of the NDAA, but supporters believe that even in an election year, when many politicians are nervous about taking a stand on immigration reform, the bill will get through.
The NDAA is a must-pass bill, so we know that by December, some form of the bill is going to become law. And the fact that we've got it in with bipartisan support in the House, you know, increases the odds of this becoming law, like, greatly.
Watching how the bill progresses will be the Sinha sisters and 200,000 young people like them, holding on to their dream of a future here in the U.S., the only place they've ever called home. For The World, I'm Rachel Miro in San Francisco.
And that's where we wrap on this Monday. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow. From PRX.